Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear. Vanity Fair.
What does it feel like on a personal level to be a Democratic senator right now?
Well, I mean, it depends on the day. There are still days when you feel like you're making important progress. And there are other days when you're sort of like observing a car crash from like many blocks away. And there's a traffic jam that is resulting from the car crash. And so there are certainly days, and more than ever, I would say even over the last like 6 or so weeks where we're just kind of, well, it was the immigration meltdown in particular, where we just sort of stared at each other and said, I don't even think we have a role here, while they sort their, you know, family dispute out. But, you know, day by day, I still love the work. It's just increasingly challenging.
Increasingly challenging. Yeah. That's the senior senator from the state of Hawaii, Brian Schatz. And I'm Brian Stelter. Welcome to Inside the Hive. Today, we're going inside the Senate during an era of extraordinary partisanship and a looming election. Mitch McConnell's recent announcement that he is stepping aside as Senate GOP leader is another testament to Donald Trump's takeover of that party. McConnell has been clashing with Trump for years, recently over military aid to Ukraine. So I wanted to hear from one of the 100, and Schatz stands out for lots of reasons. He is an eloquent communicator of the Democratic Party's message. And as you're about to hear, he calls Donald Trump the leader of a global fascist movement. But before we get to that, just how broken is the institution of the Senate? Prior to your service in Congress, you were Hawaii's lieutenant governor. You served for 8 years in the state House of Representatives. And now, as a senator, what's different now? Is it the Biden years that serving in the Senate changed? Is it just this year? You mentioned that immigration mess recently with the Republicans. When did the weather change?
Well, I think the storm clouds have been brewing for decades, right? In a certain way, the Senate in particular was insulated because of the structure of our Constitution, because people are elected statewide, because there was a sort of constitutional design that caused people to moderate their positions. But I think the House went first because of gerrymandering and sort of hyper-partisanship, and also accelerated by the internet and Donald Trump himself. And the Senate, I think, is going to be the last institution to absolutely collapse into partisanship. But, you know, that's clarifying on one level. I still believe in the United States Senate as the place where we're going to have to solve some of the biggest problems. We did infrastructure. We did the biggest climate bill in human history. We reduced the cost of insulin. And those are not problems that can be solved by local or state governments. And so I still believe in the institution. But in order for the Senate to remain relevant and important in Americans' lives, it's going to have to adapt to the current circumstances. And so the idea of sort of going back to the old Senate is not only not realistic, but it's not desirable, because part of what happened in the old Senate is the reason everybody got along, let's be clear, is that it was mostly wealthy white men who agreed with each other on the big stuff. And then they had regional and, you know, other nuanced disagreements. But it's different now. And so the old Senate, you know, people like to harken back to those days, wasn't so good for the people who weren't in the room, right? It might have been a more lovely place to work. People were kinder to each other, but there were very few Black people. There were no Asians except Daniel K. Inouye and Daniel K. Akaka. There were very few Hispanics. There were very few women. And more importantly, there was just not a diversity of opinion. And so the old Senate is not where we should go, but we're going to have to figure out what the new Senate looks like.
Isn't some of the gridlock, the dysfunction, the chaos, especially we're seeing on the Republican side, a reaction to the diversity, a reaction to the broadening of the country and the broadening cultural scope of the country?
Yeah, I suppose it is a backlash against a sort of opening the door, opening the political aperture, the community aperture, the sort of cultural questions, like who's in charge of the culture? Where is the center of gravity as it relates to culture? And I think there are people who have, for generations and generations, been at the top of that pyramid, whether it's economic or political or cultural, and are finding themselves grappling with whether or not they actually want to be welcoming other people in. That's not all it is. And I'm not a political scientist. I'm a political practitioner. But my judgment is that part of this is a backlash to all the change that has happened and the diversification of the country itself. And then part of this was a systematic program over the last 40 years with dark money to change the governing structure of the United States of America and to not allow, say, Bob Inglis, who was the first sort of climate-friendly member of the U.S. House of Representatives. He got bounced by 30 points in his primary. And basically, after that, no senator or member of the House on the Republican side was any good on climate pretty much ever since. Now, there are some exceptions and all the rest of it, but I don't want us to assume that this is purely some organic evolution of what's happening societally. This was a project. It was funded. There are C3s and C4s and C5s and corporate money and infrastructure that was designed to essentially enshrine minority rule.
Does that relate to what you have called the global fight against fascism and what you've warned is a creeping fascism in the United States? I have not seen as many senators be as blunt about this as you.
I think those things are like first cousins, but not exactly the same. I mean, I don't think as opposed to the sort of right-wing infrastructure as I am, and as much as I want to call it out on Dobbs, on IVF, on what they've done to the Supreme Court, on what they're doing on behalf of polluters, I don't think that's quite the same as just saying they are fascist. I think that's a little over simplifying the matter. I think Donald Trump is the leader of a global fascist movement, and I don't think we should be equivocal about that. And I think the challenge, and Brian, you're a media critic and a thoughtful guy, and you probably grapple with this just on a personal level, is how do you describe what is actually happening without sounding like you are, you know, standing on a box outside of Revolution Books in Honolulu, just ranting at anybody who will listen. And what happens if when you describe things exactly as they are, you sound a little nuts. And that's the problem, is that if you want to sound like you're a thoughtful, moderate, you know, deal-making pragmatist, then you're not supposed to say what is true, which is that there is now a not even a loose alliance, a pretty explicit alliance between fascists all over the planet. That includes Donald Trump, that includes shared operatives, that includes, we don't know for sure, but the possibility of certainly shared disinformation and misinformation networks and even money. And this is a project that has emerged basically in the last 10 years, and they've had more success than I think they ever anticipated.
Tell me if I'm reflecting this back correctly. There has been for decades, you know, Republican movement, a very well-funded movement, as you're saying, to drag the country to the right and to ensure corporate tax cuts and all of that. But that's a recognizable Republican Party. And then you're describing something newer, this Trump Party, which you say has those clear fascist tendencies. And that's different from the Republicans that you've worked with in the Senate for a decade.
That's the way to look at it, is like run-of-the-mill bad versus like undermining the basic tenets of democracy bad, right?
Where do we put Mitch McConnell, who recently announced he's stepping down as Senate Minority Leader at the end of the year?
Look, I think, you know, I would call him extreme in some of his actions, in particular, essentially single-handedly handing the Supreme Court of the United States to the Republicans. And so I don't want to diminish his legacy in terms of his negative impact. But I do believe that he believes in American-style democracy. I believe he's made tactical and strategic choices that sometimes were so convenient to him that I think a lot of his operatives like sort of retrofit those decisions in a way that makes them seem like they're really thoughtful and he's really playing the long game, but actually he's just sort of surviving the moment politically. But in his heart of hearts, he is not one of these guys who wants to overthrow democracy itself.
How concerned should we be that someone like McConnell feels like he doesn't fit in anymore within the Republican Party?
Super concerned. If you are a regular run-of-the-mill sort of center-right or even hard-right voter who still believes in like basic stuff, like the rule of law, if you're a right-of-center person who believes in a robust foreign policy, a muscular foreign policy, and the United States engaging in the world, Mitch McConnell, unfortunately, is increasingly out of step with at least the base of the Republican Party on the House side. And so as bad as he is, I think it may very well get worse because some of the basic things that have sort of bound us together are now in question.
And is that entirely laid at Trump's feet, or do you see others to blame for what's happened?
See, I don't know. Like, this gets into it's almost an academic discussion about if Trump didn't exist, would a Trump-like figure have emerged eventually? I guess my instinct about these kinds of things, possibly because I'm an actor in the political arena, is that people and their individual decisions and their individual campaigns, all of that actually does matter and changes the course of history. If I thought this was all sort of, we're just like in this mechanistic world where nothing any of us do makes any individual difference, then there are easier jobs to do than this one. So my judgment is that Trump was a unique accelerant. He was uniquely charismatic. And I think that's something that's difficult for Democrats to wrap their minds around, that like he's a little funny. He makes good television. You kind of want to watch him, whether it's hate watch him or love watch him.
Yeah, what's he going to do next?
It's just fun. It's good TV. And I think we all thought he was such a buffoon that we underestimated his like raw political talent. And now I think we have to admit this guy has some instincts that are pretty extraordinary. It doesn't mean he's unbeatable, because I think to internalize that message is sometimes to overlearn it and then view this guy as like unbeatable and he's got the magic and the base never leaves him. That's actually bullshit. He has only won once. He's mostly lost. He makes poor decisions all the time. They do not secretly help him. And, you know, a bunch of pollsters and pundits and Democrats are just wish casting. He's actually not great at politics, except that he has these raw instincts and this sort of magnetic appeal with a non-trivial cohort of the American voter. And so we just have to realize what we are contending with. And then the other thing that I maybe didn't quite internalize until the era of Trump is the extent to which lots of fascist leaders throughout history were characterized as buffoons. They were thought of as unserious idiots who were therefore not a threat. And so this is the model, right? Is that this guy's like, you're not sure if he's goofing. You're not sure if he's not, doesn't know what he's talking about. You're not sure if he's lying. You're not sure if he's deadly serious, but it ends up being this blank canvas onto which some voters will project whatever it is that they want out of their candidate, because basically it represents a middle finger to the system.
Well, on that note, let's take a quick break. We will return in just a minute.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Welcome back to Vanity Fair's Inside the Hive. I'm Brian Stelter, talking with Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz, who's joining us from inside his office on Capitol Hill. I never thought a decade ago that I would be asking this question, but here we are. How do you define fascism? And how do you see that in what Trump says and does and claims? I mean, I feel like some of us might have slept through that class in history because we didn't think it was ever going to apply to us in the future.
Yeah. And I think, like, look, I've read Madeleine Albright's book called Fascism, and I've thought pretty seriously about this. And certainly political scientists and historians generally consider the term still in contention. But my definition is a leader who is often elected. And I think that's the important thing to remember, is that a lot of fascists are duly elected, and then they use the tools of the government to maintain control, right? They try to use agencies, they try to use patronage, they try to use the military and police, they try to control the media to maintain a system of control over their people. They may or may not, subsequent to the first election, conduct additional elections. Fascism, to me, is characterized by making sure you maintain control and that the organs of power are no longer organs of public service, but to the aggrandizement and the maintenance of control of whoever won the election, whether it be 4 years prior or 30 years prior, because some of these people just, you know, get a bunch of judicial rulings to invalidate elections. And that, I think, is one of the things that's scary to me, is that I think it's fair to assume that if Joe Biden is successful, that there will not be another January 6th in the particular way of a mob overtaking the barricades and breaking into the Capitol, because certainly the Capitol Police and the FBI and everybody, and presumably the Maryland, DC, and Virginia National Guard are, like, not going to get caught flat-footed. I think the more terrifying and realistic scenario is that now they are lawyering this up, right? And they got their white shoe law firms to sort of try to create a legalistic veneer, so that it wouldn't be a violent overthrow, but it would be an overthrow. I mean, you listen to the way any of the potential vice presidential candidates are talking about what they would have done had they been in Pence's place. They'll all sort of, it's now standard to say, hey, I don't support any of that violent stuff, but legitimate questions, right, about whether or not the vote was legitimate. And, you know, boy, if they sent us two different slates of electors, what would we do other than, gosh, let's refer to the Constitution? And then, oh, it turns out that the House of Representatives, and they vote by state delegation, not by the numbers. And so you can sort of talk yourself into overthrowing democracy itself, but there wouldn't be a shot fired. And I think that's what we have to be especially vigilant about.
And if Trump is successful, he has said he will use his power in ways that are unprecedented. Here's a clip of one of the promises he has made.
I will immediately reissue my 2020 executive order restoring the president's authority to remove rogue bureaucrats, and I will wield that power very aggressively.
Rogue bureaucrats. What does that really mean?
I mean, this means that what he doesn't want is an independent civil service. And it's kind of like nerdy, right? Like, I'm not sure everybody wakes up in the morning and says, gosh, I hope there's an independent civil service. But I tell you what, go to any place where there's not one and you will understand how important it is. There are lots of countries in which if you want a building permit, you want a business permit, you want to get health care, you want your kid to go to school, you need to have a friend in the government itself, right? And even if you want your lights turned on, the government-run utility may extract a tip, a small bribe, just so your block is not the one without electrons running. And so this is one of those things where people, I think we were talking about this today on the floor, actually, and a colleague of mine was saying, like, we have to explain the practical impacts of fascism. And it's such a weird thing to say, wait, we have to explain the practical impacts of fascism. But I think it's very true, because nobody's really sure what that means. It sounds like just a kind of epithet that you, like, hurl at your opponents, or maybe an exaggeration. But people have to imagine a world where your basic freedoms are undermined because the government doesn't even try to play it fair. Look, there are a lot of people who feel that big bureaucracies, federal, state, and county, are, like, frustrating, and they want someone to, like, push through the thicket and kick ass and not be so concerned about all the little idiosyncratic and lawyerly requirements. Fair enough. But the alternative is much worse. The alternative is that these people are all powerful and can literally dictate whether or not you succeed or fail in life economically. And so I do think we have to flesh out what we mean by fascism, because otherwise you just sound like some hashtag resistance person, like just trying to get clicks.
We are going to take a quick break here. Back with more in a minute.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back here on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with Senator Brian Schatz from his office on Capitol Hill. One of the reasons, Senator, why I follow you on social media and I listen to your speeches is that you embed some pretty strong critiques of the press, of the mainstream media. You have a lot to say about how the press covers politics. What do you view as the biggest failings of the press when covering Democrats and Republicans?
Well, I'm sorry for doing like this typical senatorial thing and clearing my throat for 2 minutes before I answer your question, but I feel the need to do this.
Uh-oh.
Look, I think in terms of the direction that society is going, every sector needs to do some reflection. Every person needs to do some reflection. Every politician, every political party needs to do some reflection. And I guess my first critique of the press is that they are more prickly about press critique than maybe any other sector. And you sort of hear, well, you know, don't you believe in all the great work we're doing? And it's sort of like, look, when people criticize the Democrats for not getting their shit together and not being ahead by 20 points, I go, yeah, fair enough. We should be ahead by 20 points. I don't go, how dare you? I'm duly elected. And you know how important my job is? I'm thinking to myself, yeah, I'm obviously not doing everything that needs to be done because we're not ahead by 20, right? And so I want to preface it with that. But I think the problem is the bias towards newness. The media wants a new story. And the fact that Trump said a crazy thing is just not that new, right? The fact that he went on and shot his own video because he was upset that Biden made a joke on Seth Meyers is like, it's not a substantively important story. But if he were like a run-of-the-mill politician, right? Prominent politician, and he just like randomly shot a video that showed that he had like a weird grievance and a lack of self-control, it would be reported as, hey, this is pretty weird. This pretty powerful person who leads a political party is acting funky.
If you did it, you know, the publications in Hawaii would call you out.
Yeah. And I also think there would be thoughtful center left pundits lighting me on fire and going, what the hell was that? I thought Schatz was pretty thoughtful. Right. And so the bias towards newness prevents people from putting Trump on the air and prevents people from saying that which is plainly true. And one of the reasons that I think Trump is doing better in the polls than he will later is that he's actually been underexposed. And Chris Hayes has talked a little bit about this. People do forget all the stuff he said and all the stuff that he did. And when you get a press characterization of him as bombastic or norm-breaking or even unlawful, it doesn't quite capture how bananas it is that this guy was leader of the free world and wants to do it again. And so I just think the press needs to get over their own boredom with the Trump story and cover it as it is, because they are always looking for a new angle. And I think they're very sensitive, because a lot of them are, you know, just as a demographic overlay. I'm not making a specific assertion because I don't ask them about their politics, but as a demographic overlay, they have high educational attainment, which means if that's the only thing you knew about them, then a predictive model would say that they're running 65 or 70%, you know, left of center. And so I think they are hypersensitive to that critique, and therefore they bend over backwards to try to create false equivalents. And I don't want to, you know, the both sides critique has been made ad nauseum, but I think there is something to it that they can't wake up every morning and just say what they are observing, because what they are observing is substantially that one party has melted down under the weight of Donald Trump's contradictions and his fascism. And like, if you're writing for Politico and you're not a columnist and you're supposed to cover the place, you can't every day go like, well, these people are nuts and these people are like flawed, but not actually crazy. And they're at least trying, because it makes you sound like you've picked a side, when if the side is the truth, then your job is to describe things as they are and not sort of interpolate it for the public in a way where they're not exactly clear. You know, the border bill is a perfect example of that. Like there was some good reporting, but there was also some completely crazy reporting, which is to say, how does everything become a new vulnerability for Democrats, right?
That's true in coverage of the economy as well. Every story, it's changed recently, but stories about the economy are often framed as, but will this continue or is it going to hurt Biden? And there's always that kind of question.
That's right. It's either like this is tenuous and storm clouds ahead, or the story which they had to report accurately that the economy was actually doing a knock on wood gangbusters. So they did report that, but then they reported it in the context of, but why isn't it breaking through? Why is this still a political failure for the Democrats? And I think the border thing was another one of those, which is like, clever move. The Republicans killed the thing that they demanded because Trump decided that he wanted chaos on the border. Isn't this bad for Democrats? And I'm thinking, well, at some point, is everything bad for Democrats? And I think that is literally the way this town is wired, because everybody's terrified of being viewed as a partisan for describing things as they actually are.
Let's go through a few of those issues. Let's talk about the border security proposal, for example. What should the public know about the aftermath?
We had a very tough border security proposal. We had provisions in that bill that made a lot of Democrats pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I think we should start with this. I was pretty critical of like the caravan thing. I think it was two elections ago where they like just filmed a bunch of desperate people and tried to get everybody terrified that it was some sort of invasion. But just statistically speaking, what's happening on the southern border is just different. It's like 5x those numbers, first of all. It is a lot of human beings. It is not a humane situation for the people who are presenting themselves on the border. And there are no circumstances under which, let's say, TSA were overwhelmed and you just wave people through because you don't have the throughput capacity. And so I just don't think it's actually unreasonable to say our processing capacity should dictate the number of people who get waved into the country. Now, I also think those people should be allowed to work immediately, which is something that we got in the compromise, because part of the problem is you're sending people up and then they're not permitted to work for 6 months. So they're released into the country, but they're prohibited by law from working while they're pending adjudication. So it was like intentionally set up to be a mess. And so the bill we put together was, again, like a tough pill to swallow, but there was a broad recognition that we needed to do something about it. And then what happened was Donald Trump realized that these tools would be useful, would probably get the border situation substantially under control, and he would rather have the issue to try to bludgeon Democrats with. And I think that the public really needs to know sort of how nihilistic that is and how unusual that is. And I know this gets a little bit inside baseball, but listen, I'm an insider.
Yeah, let's
do it. They demanded, right, as a condition of doing Ukraine aid, that we do tough border security. And then they demanded James Langford as their lead negotiator, right? And they empowered him. They all said, James Langford, he can do it. And I presume they thought that they just wouldn't be able to land a deal and wanted to use that as an excuse to tank Ukraine aid. Some of them, you know, had a, I think, rather convoluted strategic view of like, this is the only way we get it through the House. And I just thought they were overcomplicating it and outsmarting themselves. You know, for whatever set of reasons, we had to abide by their demand and get to that deal. And then they demanded that we strip it. And like, I'm sorry. And I get that this is like not going to go in a campaign ad, right, in a swing state, but it is worth mentioning that actually is unheard of, right? I've been a legislator since 1998 in the state legislature, and you learn some very basic rules. One is that your word is your bond, right? That's the first rule in politics. And the second is you don't get to ask for something, and then when it is given to you, say, never mind, because there's no way the place can work if you operate with bad faith. And so I just think we glossed right over the bad faith. And then we had a bunch of people going like, oh, the border is a vulnerability for Democrats. And I'm thinking, is it? And by the way, I will say that, you know, polls are polls and who knows, but the polling on immigration is shifting. People are starting to internalize this idea that we had a pretty tough border bill and Donald Trump killed it. Now, is immigration going to be like our closing message as Democrats? Very unlikely. But it does put us in a better position to, with credibility, tell folks that we had a plan, that we were ready to go, and that it was Donald Trump who didn't want to solve the problem that he pretends is the abiding issue of 2024.
Is it too crass to say, is it too like cynical to say that?
No.
Every day the media talks about immigration, Trump is benefiting. And every day the media talks about abortion, Biden is benefiting. Like, is that basically what 2024 is going to be about?
So yes. I mean, I think that's correct that Republicans are a little bit better at keeping it extremely simple. And Democrats, you know, if you're sort of still on your old fashioned clicker, right? And clicking channel to channel,
right?
When the cable shows are on, you see Democrats going out there and being very persuasive, but they are not saying the same thing. One person's talking about IVF, another person's talking about Ukraine, and the Republicans go on and they get their talking points and they deliver their talking points. And so one of the challenges for politicians is, especially, frankly, in the Senate, where there are a lot of very skilled communicators with big brains, is nobody's going to be told either what to say or especially how to say it. But we're going to need to, I don't want to say dumb it down because that's an insult to people who are receiving the information. We are going to have to simplify it and try to say roughly the same thing.
I think you did that in this tweet that stood out to me. You wrote, and you're critiquing the GOP here. You say, no IVF, no premarital sex, no gay relationships, no controversial books, no reproductive choice. I don't think Democrats should start culture wars, but I do think we should win them. And I think that's the kind of framing, right? That's the messaging you're describing that can appeal to a general audience. What does it mean, though, to win those culture wars? How do you then win and finish those culture war issues?
I'm pushing on this and I'm still workshopping it. And some of the pollsters and strategy people are not so sold on this. But I think that to the extent that elections are won and lost in the suburbs nowadays, I think suburban voters are extremely adverse to weirdness. And when we seem weird, when we seem obsessed with using language that really belongs in the faculty lounge, when we use terms that nobody's ever heard of, we just alienate folks. And when we push too far on certain things, we seem like just out of the main. When it appears that we don't like cheeseburgers, right? When it appears that we don't like a stove that works really well, then we just sound like we're bananas. And even in the kind of CRT space, there was a sense that we, at the beginning of this, they were able to make us sound weird. And I think that's why Governor Youngkin is Governor Youngkin, is because the sort of Virginia suburbs were like, you know, I voted for Biden, but these guys are a little out of hand, right? And I think, and I'm not saying they were, I'm just saying that was the reaction. And the kind of COVID safetyism was also adding to all of that. And I think the script has flipped And now they just seem friggin' weird. Like they want to inspect the bodies of children participating in sports. They want to review which books a kid is permitted to use. They want to prevent people from starting a family through IVF. They want to prevent a woman from accessing reproductive health care. They want to prevent a woman who's been raped from ending that pregnancy. And those are all just weird kind of, and I don't mean this in a clinical term, but they're just like psycho positions. And if that person were next to you, in your neighborhood, you'd be like, I don't know, like you're not inviting that person over for dinner. And so part of what I think, oh, well, I'll add to this, by the way, they're now anti-football, for God's sake. Like, I'm serious. That seems like some trivial thing, but like—
Why, because of Taylor Swift?
Yeah, because of Taylor Swift and it's an op and it's really bananas. And I just think that we have to unapologetically grab the mainstream of the United States and say, hey, we just want to leave you alone, right? We want there to be a basic social safety net. We want to invest in infrastructure. We want to make sure that people can afford their lives, healthcare and energy and everything else. We want there to be a good, solid education system. We want your votes to count. We don't want anything to be affirmatively unfair to any group or subgroup. Like those are mainstream American positions. And these guys seem like they came flying out of the worst cesspool on the internet and are now the nominees. Like we have to really understand that a lot of where we land as Democrats are like 65-35 issues. And that wasn't always the case on the culture wars, right? Mm. Gay rights was not that popular. Abortion was 50-50. A lot of the stuff that we are now winning decisively on, we didn't used to win decisively on, but we still have some muscle memory that is causing us to be a little cautious about these culture wars. There's sort of a school of thought is like we should always pivot to kitchen table issues. I'm a little less attached to that. But I do think there is a way we can say these freaks are focused on nothing that matters to you and your family. Nothing, except to the extent that they can harm your personal freedoms. And I just don't think Democrats always have the confidence that they have the American people behind them. So we sort of like tiptoe a bit.
You were talking about some of those key issues that what voters want to hear about, right? Affordability, for example. You've been proposing solutions to the lack of affordable housing, something that's, arguably been behind the rise of homelessness and other problems in major cities. What can you implement? What are the practical solutions to that lack of affordable housing?
So I'm glad you asked that question for two reasons. First, I'm very passionate about it. Second of all, I've been so partisan that I want to give myself an opportunity to criticize Democrats.
Okay.
I think Democrats are evolving, but are basically not great on housing. We're better than the Republicans because at least we want to fund things like housing authorities and the low-income housing tax credit and whatever else it is. But the truth is that states and counties have made it nearly impossible to build housing. These are government-created shortages. And then we sort of stroke our chins and wonder what happened. And you go to any sort of well-educated 70-30 Democratic suburb, and they are shitty on housing. They are absolutely theoretically for working people living next to them and making a life, and they are personally kind, but they can't see past save Block B, whatever Block B may be, whether it's in Virginia or, Honolulu or Maui. Like everybody thinks that housing should be built and but not next to them. So I am a proud YIMBY. I am a yes in my backyard person.
Yeah.
I think that is the progressive position. And I think the only reason that being anti housing is considered a left position is because people who are otherwise left wing already got their houses. And one thing that I didn't quite internalize until I got on the banking committee is the extent to which restrictive zoning, covenants, minimum lot size, all of that was what happened after Jim Crow was outlawed. And the Realtors Association nationally sat down with the racists and tried to figure out how they could come up with proxies for race that functioned to continue segregation in housing that could still pass scrutiny of the courts. And that's what they did. They ended up with all this zoning stuff. And then left-wing organizations decided environmental organizations decided that there was kind of a coalition to be built there, but it's really gross. And I think if we're talking in intersectional terms, which I think the left loves to talk about, we have to talk about the fact that we are in coalition with people who are quite shitty on housing. And I don't think it's impossible for us to change that, but we have to speak it plainly.
And here's one more issue I wanted to ask you about. I was struck by your recent announcement about a child safety bill. This is addressing, the social media age, the anti-social media age is really the better term for it. What are you proposing? And will any of this have any chance of getting through the Senate this year?
I think there's a chance to pass legislation, meaningful legislation on social media and kids. My bill is super straightforward. It simply bans kids 12 and under from having a social media account. And then it raises the age verification standard. What does that mean? It means that you would no longer be able to just click, yeah, I'm 18, in order to confirm your age. This is not a particularly complicated technological feat, but part of the problem is that kids are just clicking, yeah, I'm 18, and moving on. And then for 13 through 17, there would be a ban on the algorithmic boosting of your feed. And I think you know, Brian, that part of what's happening with kids is that these algorithms are just too powerful. They're probably too powerful for adults, but they are certainly too powerful for the brain of an adolescent kid. Look, more than 50% of all teenage girls say they consistently experience despair. More than half of all teenage girls consistently experience despair. This is a crisis unlike any other that I've ever seen in history. And it is, you know, what some of like the Meta people are like, we need longitudinal data on whether or not this is actually social media. Well, listen, what they mean by longitudinal data is they want to wait a generation to gather information. They want to stall for another 10 years to have some scientific rigor behind. They're stalling. Everybody knows what's happening because all of this spike in bad mental health outcomes, right, coincides exactly with the advent of the smartphone. It is a one-to-one relationship. So we don't have to pretend we don't know what's happening. The data is there, but also anybody who's a parent is just begging for this law to be passed. It's not the only thing that needs to be happening, but I think if we can pass a law that delays the onset of social media participation until 13, that a lot of families will be very, very grateful.
Mm. And this should be easy to find Republican co-sponsors for.
I have been able to find Republican co-sponsors for our original bill. We're now making modifications, so we have to kind of do another round of negotiations. But I was struck by, I was in the Commerce Committee and I talked a little bit about this bill before, you know, we weren't actually voting on it, but I talked about it. And, you know, Dan Sullivan and Ted Cruz and I think Eric Schmidt and a couple of others were like, yeah, count me in, man. Because if there's one thing that unites parents, it's the sort of terror of what your 12-year-old is looking at when they close the door at night or when they wake up in the morning. And, you know, it's easy to say if you are not a parent, right? We're going to just enable you to, you know, to have a conversation with your kid and turn the dials on all the settings on the social media account. Well, you know, best wishes. But I think most people would like a federal law so that you don't have to be individually refereeing what your kid is doing at all times.
I really hope that it, despite the car crash you described, that you're watching from far away this disaster that, you know, maybe some cars can get through the traffic jam, of these bills can get through the traffic jam.
Well, listen, you know, hope springs eternal. And I think about politics, like, I don't know, golf or fishing or surfing. You can have a very unsuccessful session and then you have like one, you know, shoot one good shot or get one good wave and you go, I should go back. This is great. And I do feel that way, that you can have 2 or 3 days or 2 or 3 weeks of sort of just a slog and deeply frustrating. And then you can enact something that's incredibly important. And, you know, if you don't have that attitude, then, you know, this probably isn't the job for you.
Senator Schatz, thanks for taking us inside the Senate.
Thanks a lot, Brian. Take care.
This episode of Inside the Hive was produced by Michael May. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. We had engineering assistance today from Gabe Quiroga, and mixing by Bob Mallory. I'm Brian Stelter. You can find me on Twitter and Threads at Brian Stelter, or feel free to reach out to me directly. Email me anytime. I'm at bstelter@gmail.com. I really appreciate your feedback about last week's program and your ideas for future guests. We'll be back in your podcast feed next week.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.